This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Orfila Center and Trends, thanks for coming and thanks for making it a really excellent conference so far. I don't know about you, but after 2 days of all of this very rich discussion, I feel like we're at the end of Thanksgiving feast. And everybody's kind of pushed away from the table a little bit and loosening the belt. And I'm standing here saying, just one more slice. I'll try to be brief. I'll try to present it in a way that you find at least a little entertaining and hopefully rely on a lot of you giving me feedback, because this is, I think, the third topic that we were working on for this particular conference, and I'm going to blame Michael for changing his mind on it several times. So this is a story, I think, that fits really well with the last presentation about how we construct counterterrorism matters, was the last line on the slide. And this is a story about how we construct a threat matters in how we construct a response to that threat. This is going to be a story basically in three parts. So the first part, I'm going to describe what I think is three categories or three ways that the current big threat dash is constructed, both in the media and by elites, political elites. Second, I'll describe a construction of the response to that threat. And then finally, we enter a little bit more of a theoretical discussion and critique that response. Because of the discussion we've had so far, I'll be able to comment and maybe integrate a little bit of what's gone on. So first off, the three constructions of Daesh. The first is Daesh as a quasi-state. It was described when it first started action in Iraq as being an insurgency, something that the Iraqi army had to deal with, that the Syrians in that civil war had to deal with, or that was part of the problem. But basically, we were thinking about it in Iraq as an insurgency. Then it became a conventional army when it started to take and hold cities, when it started to hold artillery pieces and tanks, and it started to make parades. Then it became a real conventional army. That was very well equipped, unfortunately, with a lot of American hardware. We see them in the MRAPs and the Humvees that they took. It's also been constructed as a government with laws and a bureaucracy, and we see that in the media as well. But it's also seen as a violator of international human rights law. So the cruelty that we hear about with Daesh. And there's a few quotes that I can give you about that. Sometimes it's been described as something new and more sinister and maybe even more fearsome than Al-Qaeda. So we're going back to that comparison that a new thing, a terror group, is often compared to Al-Qaeda, sort of it's like it or it's not like it. So ISIL or Daesh is the new face of Al-Qaeda and the larger radical Islamist movement. ISIL has already accomplished what the 9/11 Al-Qaeda only dreamt about but forfeited when they overreached and attacked the American people. And that was the retired General Keane testifying before the House Foreign Affairs Committee. Another former U.S. ambassador to Iraq said, "The turn of events in Iraq over the past month leading to the establishment of the Islamic State by the Al-Qaeda in Iraq offshoot group is a stunning blow to U.S. policy and objectives in the Middle East. The creation of an extremist quasi-state analogous to Afghanistan under the Taliban carries the risk of further escalation, including a regional Sunni-Shia conflagration and the dramatic loss in U.S. influence in the region." So in that statement by the former ambassador from the United States to Iraq, he made the comparison between both Al-Qaeda and the Taliban as something bigger, nastier, and more competent in some way. Secondly, Daesh has been constructed as the inspiration of transnational terrorism. It's become a brand of sorts. It collects supporters with a very sophisticated marketing plan. The ways that Fortune 500 companies like Apple or Ford market their products. Dash is showing that it's very sophisticated and capable at doing something that's just as good as that, and it's been successful at that. It's also been described as a central organization with franchises like McDonald's or affiliates like NBC has affiliates in various towns. So maybe not directly controlling the activity of those affiliates like in Sinai or in Afghanistan or in Libya, but indeed having some measure of control and maybe a little bit of inspiration and also some material support. Finally, Dash has been constructed as a clandestine threat, something that we should fear, but we can't really see all that well right now. And at first, prior to, we say, you know, Paris, prior to the Metrojet bombing, we see it as being Westerners returning from the battlefield on their passports to wage the jihad back home. More recently, we see it as a Trojan horse, so to speak, of terrorists hidden among refugee movements that pose a threat in that way, that they're hidden in that way. And there's several interesting quotes along that line. Let's see here. The threat from returnees is real and growing. This is House of Representatives Homeland Security Committee Chairman Michael McCaul wrote in a Time magazine piece, "The threat from returnees is real and growing." So that was in 2014. "These battle-hardened, violent Islamists have the training and extremist networks to plot deadly terrorist attacks against our homeland." And then more recently, we find that equally worrisome, this is the same person but writing more recently now, equally worrisome is that terrorists might use refugee groups as a Trojan horse to get into the West. Hundreds of thousands of Syrian refugees have poured into Turkey this year, and many of them have left for other European countries by boat. This final construction, the Trojan horse construction, has been basically refuted, that the refugee program is really rigorous. The UN vetting of refugees takes more than a year or two. And then sort of as a response to that, if we say that, well, this is not as big a threat as we think, then they say, well, that's not a threat, but this is, and that's this visa waiver program. All right, so I don't believe Daesh really needs to sneak in and use the migration flow to send fighters to Europe. Gilles de Kirchhoff, a counterterrorism coordinator for the European Union. First, they can tap the huge reservoir of Europeans who are already radicalized and inspire them, but they also may send back Europeans who went abroad for jihad, and some of them may not have been detected by police. And then Richard Burr, chairman of the Senate Select Committee of Intelligence, warned, "I would tell you from a threat standpoint, I'm probably more concerned with the visa waiver program today. Were I in Europe already and wanted to go to the United States, and were I not on a watch list or no-fly list, and I wanted to get there, the likelihood is that I would use the visa waiver program before I would try to pawn myself off as a refugee." So you have the three constructions. So Daesh is a state with the military, it has a government, it has laws, it controls territory. You have Daesh as a brand name, a propaganda machine, a marketing machine that can inspire people at a great distance. And then you have Daesh as this clandestine threat, a Trojan horse, perhaps, or some other kind of a threat from abroad, but actually people moving across national boundaries. All right, so those are the three constructions. Now I'll describe the construction of the response to that. And I think that it's pretty obvious what that response is we're at war. François Hollande, the president of France, said as much. France is at war. Okay, it's pretty clear. I actually looked it up. The French Constitution, just like the U.S. Constitution, the president can't declare war. It actually has to be a parliamentary act. But that's probably beside the point. He didn't care. It's a rhetorical device. We will pursue these attacks throughout the coming weeks. On Thursday, aircraft carrier Charles de Gaulle will go to the Eastern Mediterranean, and that will treble our capacity for action. Right? There will be no pity and no fear. The ones who organized the Paris attacks must realize their crimes rather than making France fear responding reinforces our determination to destroy them. It should be noted that France was already at war at that point. A year ago, after the Charlie Hebdo attacks, the Prime Minister of France said that France was at war. So France was already at a state of war, at least according to another politician. The United Nations Security Council got in the game and said that they call on all states, all member states, to take necessary measures in compliance with international law to redouble and coordinate their efforts to prevent and suppress terrorist acts committed specifically by ISIL, also known by Daesh, as well as ANF, and all other groups, undertakings, and entities associated with al-Qaeda, and to eradicate the safe haven they have established under significant parts of Iraq and Syria. So the Security Council then is authorizing military action to eradicate that safe haven. Because of an attack in Western Europe, the UN Security Council took action and said, it's okay for you to go to war and bomb Raqqa, for instance. And it's not just politicians. Tom Brokaw, who was for 22 years anchored the NBC's flagship the evening news program, said on the 22nd of November, he said, "I don't want this broadcast to end without all of us dealing with the new reality. We're at war. This has changed. Paris has changed the place of America in this war against ISIS, and it is now a war. The president's what I would call benign neglect about continuing expansion of ISIS, the more sophistication of all the time, has to come to a halt." So it's not just the politicians that are saying we're at war, but other usually steady-minded people, you could say media personalities are continually suggesting that this thing changed everything. Again, it's sort of like 9/11 changed everything. This changed everything, and now we're at war. That's right. So that's the construction. All right, so the constructions of Daesh, three of them, the construction of the response is clearly one of war. And now, just a little bit of critique, I guess, is what's the coming. The three constructions, in my mind, are often merged. All right, so you if you have the three, they are distinguishable, they're distinct. But you can have a conversation about Daesh is a Trojan horse, so we need to go to war. And in fact, one of the politicians that I forget his name, he's in the paper, but I'm not going to dig out his quote, said that I'd rather fight them in their backyard than I would like to fight them in mine. So the idea is going back to we'd rather fight them over there than fight them over here, which is what the same construction was right after 9/11. So fighting, but fighting over there, right? So that's one thing. So they merge the three constructions. So maybe they forget some elements, or they ignore the fact that an attack happened here, but we're going to go over here. And then the response is to then create or to do the most visible thing you can, which is to blow stuff up in a foreign country, right? And so that's the clearly response. It's easy to point to and say we are doing things because stuff is blowing up in that country. But really what's happening is that you're doing counter-terror operations in one state, in Syria and Iraq. You're trying to decapitate the leadership of the organization. You're trying to deny them safe haven. You're trying to destroy their equipment. But what you're doing is you're applying that counter-terror strategy to what's basically an insurgency, a military problem that requires a wholly different kind of response if you really want to take away that property that they have. And they're doing that in order to secure Europe and North America. So you have a counter-terror strategy being applied to an insurgency in order to secure a population that's far away from where you're doing most of your the most visible end of your activity. there's been a lot of discussion in so far, I think, in the conference I guess so far it's sort of ending, you know, in the next, you know, hour or so, about war fighting versus law enforcement. So, and I think it's been interesting, is that the one of the things that I think you can walk away from this conference if you just dropped in and you didn't know much about it, is that the terrorism experts say war is not a really good response. You really should do law enforcement. And that's kind of the major walk away that if you didn't really know anything else about it. So war fighting, in a sense, from my perspective, privileges combatants, right? So war, a combatant has the right to kill, but also has the liability of being targeted to be killed. But war also is supposed to protect non-combatants. And so that's a positive. But on the other hand, war fighting also excludes what I would say legal adjudication of combatants, right? So if someone does, the enemy, the bad guys over there, if war, as Clausewitz says, war is the aim or the objective of war is the destruction of enemy forces. So if I have bad guys abroad doing bad things, I have to kill them or I put them in prison for a long time and never think about them again. It excludes the possibility of trying them, of convicting them in that way. Law enforcement privileges due process, right? With obvious management, obvious constraints to that, right? It also avoids the combatant non-combatant distinguishment. Everybody is a non-combatant in that sense, right? There's just people that violate the law, and there are victims of criminals. So the only thing that I can think of as someone that, you know, used to work for the FBI is that law enforcement tends to focus on reacting to crime. So to try a crime happens, you investigate the crime, you find out who did it, you punish that person. It's not as good at trying to prevent crime, although they've had some successes, I guess. So I guess maybe to conclude is that messy constructions can lead to messy responses. So if you have three distinguishable elements, and if you push them together or if you ignore certain elements and then you respond to them, you can get an incoherent response to that. Each of the three constructions of Dash as presented contains some truth, right? So with the exception of maybe the refugee problem, so we've kind of quashed that. However, each of the three constructions require, I think, a distinct response to that. So that would be maybe the so what of the paper. I'm going to self-critique just preemptively. Is that not fair? I'm gonna preemptively critique. One, this is definitely a work in process. The three constructions, Michael and I kicked around some ideas about how to categorize these things in a coherent way. Right, so I think what needs to happen, the next step, is to better connect them to the theoretical discussion that follows. Right? So, if we're talking about the constructions, what does that mean for the theory, and what does theory tell us about how to make those constructions better? And then I think that the theoretical discussion at the end needs to be better linked, or to more directly address the response question. So, and that would be it. So, pending your questions, that's it.
Okay, we got a final last bit. It was a last-minute addition, but something we thought would be quite useful. James from the Santa Barbara Council for Foreign Relations got in touch with us, introduced us to Alan Cullison, who I'll introduce in a moment. And I just want to thank James for intervening and also for being here as well. Certainly appreciate your presence. Alan is a correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, based in Moscow for a number of years. But he's also the individual that got his hands on al-Qaeda computers in Afghanistan. And essentially, we just see this as a nice little wrap-up to our discussions. Alan's going to provide a short sort of discussion and presentation, and then we're going to open the floor for a wider discussion. So, Alan, thank you very much for coming. The floor is yours.
So I arrived here without a business card, and I came up with an ingenious solution to the problem for those of you who want to write it down. That's where to find me. I really would like to keep in touch with people here. This has been a very interesting experience for me. I've have been covering insurgencies and terror and that sort of thing for more than 15 years for the journal, and I haven't really had the opportunity to, while I've been writing, I haven't really had the opportunity to hear what people have been saying about it and engaging in this kind of analysis, with the exception of maybe in 2003 or 2004 when I had a sabbatical at Harvard after, this is when I was working on the Al-Qaeda hard drives, and I really feel like the discussion of this subject has gotten a lot more astute and measured, and I suppose that's the result of bitter experience. I'm feeling pretty fulfilled by it, but anyway, my work is, of course, not at all theoretical. The methodology of a journalist is basically based on the assumption that if you describe something well enough, the solutions will become clear. In that regard, I thought what I'd do is just talk about a few of the things that I've covered at the journal, and then offer a couple of observations about the ideas that I found useful in structuring what I found. I mean, essentially I've been forced to write about things without understanding them, because it has been the first draft of history at its best. The journal at its best used to encourage reporters, and when the journal was at its best, I mean before Rupert Murdoch bought it, get reporters to give a worm's eye view of what was going on out there, and I'll touch on a few things in particular. This was the work on suicide bombers that I did in Afghanistan. Since suicide bombing was pretty much non-existent before, I forget what year it really got started. Well, I think it was like 05, 06 that it really started taking off. A little bit on ISIS recruits, specifically among the Chechen community. Then, of course, this 40-gigabyte hard drive that I got in Kabul that was essentially property of the Al-Qaeda Bureau, but it was mainly Ayman Zawahiri's. And then some work on the Boston bombers, because I had a peculiar relationship with the family before the bombings. I guess, I'm tempted to say, but since I'm conscious that everyone wants to get out of here, working in Russia, I have always been interested in the phenomena of terror, or at least modern terror, as something with Russian roots. You know, this whole idea of Kropotkin speaking about propaganda by deed, and I would like it if there was more discussion about state terror, because it does seem to be a subject that's not addressed enough, and it might be a way to drag out into the open the more nettlesome question of what terror is and what terror isn't. I mean, I think probably the first real terror acts that I covered were in 99 in the apartment bombings in Moscow and Volgodonsk that killed about 300 people while you were asleep. Apartments were blown up, and this was what partly led to the Second Chechen War and the rise of Vladimir Putin. It's not really clear. There's no evidence that the Russian government did those bombings, but it is clear that the Russian government never wanted anyone to investigate those bombings. So I think it's actually a chapter that people ought to be working on. Anyway, the first sustained work on terror was for me in Afghanistan. And the hard drives, and when I start talking about this always leads to questions about how I got them, and so I'm just going to preemptively explain that. I, after 9/11, was among dozens of journalists who tried to get into Afghanistan to write about the fighting there. If you recall, the Northern Alliance controlled a small strip of northern Afghanistan at that time. A lot of people crowded toward the borders. Some of them went to Uzbekistan. A bunch of others went through Pakistan and tried to get into the country. I went to Tajikistan, and the border there was open. I was not getting along with my editor. My editor hated me. I hated him. And I, for that reason, I went very far into Afghanistan, knowing that when I crossed the Hindu Kush, the passes would close from the snow, and I wouldn't be able to be called out, and I would successfully be able to stay there and write as long as I wanted. I was successful, I was by this time an experienced war correspondent and very good in the art of deception, and as you can see, it was very hard to tell who I was, and I mixed in perfectly. Telling this, I always have to show people a picture of my car. As we were crossing the Hindu Kush, we lost our brakes and rolled down it. I was part of a convoy of five vehicles, and I think one made it. That was how the laptop that I had was broken. And for the next few weeks, when I was stuck in the Panjshir Valley, which is north of Kabul, I basically had to write everything by hand and phone it in over a satellite phone to my editors. When Kabul fell, there was a race with the New York Times. At this point, I was pretty much outnumbered. I was the only journal correspondent in Afghanistan, Pakistan. There was Danny Pearl and another guy, Steve Levine, and the New York Times started getting documents out of al-Qaeda houses, and I, being behind, had already gotten to know computer dealers, and so started looking for hard drives to sort of overtake them. And there were not many computer dealers, of course, in Afghanistan at that time because there was no electricity. If you had a transistor radio, you were very high-tech. There was a fellow who... What I was looking for was the computer of Muhammad Atif, who was the military commander at the time. And I found a fellow who said that he had Atif's computer. And in fact, he had two computers. The one that he said was very valuable was a laptop owned by Atif, and but he also had a desktop computer. He wouldn't give me the laptop, but I got the desktop from him, and on the desktop there was this letter in French, which, if you remember, just before 9/11, al-Qaeda assassinated the head of the Northern Alliance, Ahmed Massoud. Seeing that this was on the hard drive, it was clear that that was an important computer, and for that reason I negotiated to get that computer as well as Muhammad Atif's laptop. Both of them were locked by passwords. In order to get through a locked password on these desktops, what you could do is take out a small, basically something the size of a watch battery, and get through. And so I was able to copy the IBM computer, but not the laptop. When I called my editors and said, hey, I've got Muhammad Atif's laptop, I'm going to come back to the United States and we're going to copy it, they had a bit of a panic attack and called Central Command, and both the computers were collected from me, and one of which I had not copied. I guess it's a bit of a digression, but I'll speak quickly. I think it's actually quite interesting. In gratitude, the Langley gave me a briefing on what they found on these computers, and they said That IBM desktop that you gave us, was full of, had lots of information. The one that you copied. Unfortunately, the laptop didn't have anything on it. We found five things of value. We found a system of encryption on the computer, the dictionary for that encryption, a letter casing report by Richard Reed, the shoe bomber of Targets, a casing report of the U.S.-Canada border, and then a list of al-Qaeda members, 170 of them, half of them we don't know. We're going out and looking for them. And then they gave me copies of these documents. In order to get through the computer, and this is just basically a screenshot of the computer, all of these were locked. You had to go through every one and run a brute force password attack, which took some time. We went through it and found all these documents that the guys at Langley said were there, but we found the Richard Reed report, the encryption system, but then we couldn't find this list of al-Qaeda members, and then we noticed on the document that they gave us, the list of al-Qaeda members, up at the top there was a translator's note, and it said, this is a list of al-Qaeda members found on the Muhammad Atif laptop computer. So we went back to them and said, this is, ridiculous. We dealt with you in good faith. What happened here? And then they were silent for about a month and came back and they said, well, that was the other Muhammad Atif laptop computer that we had sitting around and we just mistakenly gave you that thing. Anyway, there are an awful lot of things that I could say about al-Qaeda and a lot of them I think that you've heard already. On this drive, there are about 800 pieces of correspondence organized neatly into different various folders, in and out of, for instance, Yemen, from different authors. This was, I believe, that the creator of this system of the mail in and out was done by Muhammad Zawahiri, Ayman's brother. Until Muhammad got arrested, and then the whole system fell apart, and it got a lot more difficult to analyze what was going on. But cracking these things, you expect great revelations, and oddly, I think some of the most important things to be said about it was that you look for operational planning all the time, but what they're concerns were pretty quotidian a lot of the time. When I was stuck up in the Panjshir Valley before the Taliban fell, all the journalists who I was stuck there, living in mud huts, suffering from giardia, I lost about 30 pounds. People were saying, God, we have to get out of here. The Afghans are stealing from us. You'd open up the documents here, and the Arabs would say, "We got to get out of here." The Afghans are stealing from us. People wanted to go to London. People wanted to go to Yemen. People wanted to go to anywhere, and get out of here. The Albania folder was particularly interesting because it was revealed in some ways how enticing the whole strategy of assassination would be for fighting al-Qaeda, because it's basically a lot of correspondence about how everyone there was getting picked up and ferried back to Egypt and hanged. But generally, it was sort of a story about a story about the desperation of an organization that was underfunded, people kind of on the verge of, psychological problems. It was in Arabic, it was in French, a bit of Tagalog. I never figured out what this was, but I think it was somebody who probably just lost it and was deported. But A lot of the writings, of course, were of Zawahiri himself, and I guess you all probably know quite a bit about Zawahiri. He's kind of an awful person, even by terrorist standards. He was very hard to get along with, but his organization, you know, his people in Egyptian Jihad, were having terrible financial problems. And one of the more interesting things that I found here was a correspondence that after, you know, when after Sudan, they all left Sudan, they were looking for a new home, essentially. And down in Dagestan, I got a copy of his passport. This is actually a copy from the police in Mahachkala, Dagestan. And reconstructing his travels in his passport, it showed he was going all sorts of places after Sudan, trying to find a home, essentially. And one of the last places that he went was Derbent, in Derbent, trying to get to Mahachkala so that he could get into Chechnya and create it, you know, and use that as a base. He was arrested. Had the Russians found out who he was, I don't think anything good would have happened to him, but he had a false passport, and apparently they never learned who he was. It was a very close call, and after that, he went to Afghanistan. I thought it was the success that he... So what he learned from this, I think, was that... Well, what he learned from it, it was clear what emerged from his narrative was that they, when in trouble, it was the reaction was to up the ante. It was then that he got together with bin Laden, and they did have enormous problems with the Taliban, I guess it was in 97. There was talk about Mullah Omar being unhappy with bin Laden and, you know, issuing phony fatwas about this and that and speaking about ejecting them. The relationship seemed to turn around after the bombing of the coal and the missile strikes on Afghanistan. It got Mullah Omar terribly angry. And then after 98, you began to see some correspondence about the big job, which, of course, appeared to be the September 11th attacks. And you can see sort of a bit of bin Laden's... We talk about their ability to manipulate, to play us. I think that this is really... this is recurrent all through the drive. You know, in October 3, from this letter, this was shortly after the U.S. started bombing the front lines of the Taliban, basically destroying everything. You know, bin Laden essentially wrote this letter to Mullah Omar saying, you know, look, yeah, this is bad, but you got to sort of keep in mind the long-term plan here. We're going to draw them in. They're going to be, you know, well, like I said, this is going to transform the U.S. into a third-rate power. They will overreact. They were seeking overreaction, and of course, they got it. So anyway, the logic of these people was very true or very very sound as far as I could tell. And so at least working for the journal, I haven't really ever taken much interest in the whole issue of whether terror groups are rational. I mean, this seems extremely rational to me. I think they played us very well. The success, of course, of the military forces, the U.S. in Afghanistan was unexpected, but, you know, they, of course, did very well elsewhere. For that reason, I had gotten interested more in radicals on an individual level, precisely because there was a lot of correspondence in al-Qaeda about the difficulty of finding suicide bombers. They could not get Afghanis to volunteer for these things for some reason. there was generally a low regard for Afghanis among them. You know, they're basically unlettered people who can't understand the Quran except on an emotional level, and hence not really. And, you know, the suicide bomber thing was difficult. But that began to change, I guess it was 05, 06. And so I started going into the prisons, Policharki prison, to interview failed bombers. This guy's name was Rahmat Khan, age 30. He was arrested wearing a suicide vest in Khost. He had said that he was duped into a martyrdom operation. Somehow, I guess, thought he was just getting a job sweeping floors, and they put a suicide vest on him. And but I'm not sure the prison authorities that said that they thought he was going to change his story. He was going through interrogations at the time, but his job was selling, or his only work was selling ballpoint pens from a cart and making about $10 a month. So I suspect that what he was an easy recruit. This fellow's name was Khan. He was unusual as a suicide bomber in the sense that he was Tajik, not Pashto. Age 20, he said that he was feeling depressed, had no prospects, and at some point some friends had suggested if you're going to commit suicide, the best thing to do would be to take some Americans with him. And the indoctrination process was very similar to what I heard here earlier. You know, you're brought to a house, shown a lot of videos, constantly rolling, and you get used to it. You're there with a lot of other suicide bombers, and soon you're off on your mission. He went off, was going to drive a truck into a convoy, and a convoy of American vehicles, but had stopped by the side of the road to relieve himself, and got seized. Anyway, the this guy, I'd forgotten this guy's name. The conversation didn't last very long because my translator was scared of him. And he had to leave. He was a dangerous man. what emerged, I can only sort of come up with theories on what's common between these people, and it's dangerously intuitive. But what was suggested to me by authorities in Afghanistan at that time was that the first bombers were what they regarded, or from what they regarded as modern society. That Afghanistan was actually an old-fashioned society, that if you were a kid thinking about going off and putting on a suicide vest, there were village elders around who would tell you not to. These young gentlemen were often from Pakistani tribal camps. Maybe they were Afghanis, but their villages had been disrupted, people had been killed, and so they were easy targets for people who knew that they were unattached and therefore radicalized that way. I had kind of think that for that reason, as a journalist, I've been sort of interested in the whole process of indoctrination of people who are outside outside respectable society. It's interesting if you look at Richard Reed. If you want to do a very informal statistical analysis, get on Factiva and put in as search words Reed and Strange. And you will find, you know, all these people came off the plane after he tried to bomb it, and you know, journalists would ask, well, what was he like? And then people would say, he was strange, you know, and he was, you know, he looked strange, he acted strange. I would like to contrast him somehow, if I can get. I have been writing back and forth with Richard now that he's in prison. I'd like to contrast him with Saeed Badat, who you may know. There was a second shoe bomber. He was supposed to pull off the shoe bombing the same time as Reed. But instead of doing that, he sent a cryptic note to Al-Qaeda saying, I'm afraid Van Damme is going to have to be on his own, and then disappeared. He went off the map, and what happened was his parents talked to him. That was sort of the thing that I think that that, or at least I think that was the main reason that he didn't go. For ISIS, I have been asked by the Journal to profile various people. One of them, largely Chechens. I started rolling videotape when I was YouTube video to select somebody, and this guy interested me because he was speaking in Russian a lot, but with a Georgian accent. I went to Georgia and began asking around the Chechen community about him, and it turned out he was a, that's him on the left, he was a former officer in an intelligence unit of the Georgian army, of course trained by the U.S., not him personally, but his unit and the people around him. He was a very successful soldier, but fell on bad times when he got tuberculosis and was kicked out of the army and then thrown in jail, and the Brotherhood got to him there, and he had a conversion. Now he's really one of the top commanders for ISIS in Syria. Covering Chechens specifically makes for a pretty small world. This was the Tsarnaev family, as I knew them, because when I went to the United States for a sabbatical, I did try to get to know people in the Chechen community. Anzor Tsarnaev, when I knew this family, they didn't speak much English, and so I used to go to their house and have dinner some. Anzor, I had a 64 Buick Wildcat. Anzor was an excellent mechanic. He and I used to work on my car. This is him the day after Tamerlan was killed in the shootout with police. Anyway, there are a lot of useful things I've heard at this conference that do describe some of the people I've dealt with. I'm fearful of mentioning any of the expense of others. I really do think it would be useful if we did spend more time studying what we do to these societies rather than what terrorists do to us. Not because it's unimportant what terrorists do to us, but because this metaphor of watching a boxing match with only one boxer particularly sticks in my mind. And our whole reaction of what we do, or our whole notion of how we should react, is of course very important, because they do expect us to react in a certain way, and their terror acts are patterned accordingly. I think, of course, that it also would be extremely relevant for there to be more discussion about this among the press, because de facto, reporters have become combatants in this. I mean, I became a combatant when I ended up giving these hard drives to the CIA. I think, as you all well know, my colleague Danny was kidnapped and beheaded. And this was about 2 days after Ashcroft congratulated the Wall Street Journal for its patriotism in handing over these hard drives. I don't think it's a coincidence that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed personally was the guy who killed him. I think that there are recently declassified documents that suggest that they did think he was a combatant, and that there really wasn't any difference between the press and any other information gatherer. As far as standing way back on what motivates these people, I've heard reference to a certain University of Chicago highly paid University of Chicago political scientist. I really found this database on all the suicide attacks around the world since 80 very intriguing, and just because it's so straightforward, this theory that suicide terror is a response to foreign occupation. All the people that I've dealt with seem to regard themselves as simply violent altruists. And I am aware of some of the criticisms of Pape. I guess Robert Pape, I'm sure everybody knows who he is. I'm very intrigued by academic writing in the sense that I don't understand a lot of it. I think Pape sort of falls down a little bit when it comes to explaining transnational terror. I guess that this is an excerpt that I thought was sort of fun. Transnational suicide terror is a classic instance of individuals with multiple national loyalties, but, you know, you can read the rest. It's a journalist would write it somewhat differently. It's some people immigrate but still feel loyalty to the places they come from, maybe. But there's an overarching thing here that that I'm personally interested in that is, again, completely what's the word for it? Conceptual, I'll say. I'm very interested in the whole phenomenon of indoctrination. The role of conspiracy theory and how people get wrapped into certain beliefs. And one thing that does seem to be common between a lot of these guys is that there seems to be a paranoid foundation. Conspiracy theory seems to be a paranoid foundation of all these groups. Breivik's big tome was very, very, I don't know, it reminded me an awful lot of Bin al-Shib's, which I found on the hard drive, justifying the attacks. Al Qaeda. I mean, some of the last delirious notes that I found on the Al Qaeda hard drive from Kabul was this sort of rambling history about the Masons. The United States does not control the Masons. The Masons control the United States. And they are going to come into your home and get you with their popular culture. There's a recurrent theme that there is an apocalypse coming, and now is the time for heroes to act. Tamerlan, writing about the Tsarnaev family, it wasn't really just writing about the Tamerlan going nuts. It was sort of about the whole family. And this was a very popular book in the family. And, you know, it was not just because somebody has, I did go through his library. And it's not just because somebody has a book on their shelf doesn't really mean much. But Tamerlan was a very active reader. And when you go through it, you could see that he was, one of his problems, at least when I knew him when he was 15, was that he really hadn't learned English very well. And it looked like he wasn't going to. The last page here, you can see he had his vocabulary listings of, you know, starting with Gentile, ending with Mason. He was also a Rand Paul fan. I don't know exactly what to, I haven't written much about that yet, but I I think that these are. Besides conspiracy theory, I sort of wish that there was a bit. I'm also intrigued by the whole role of losers, not losers in the in the sort of economically depressed outcast ways, but you know, I think just because the definition of loser is much broader, there are far more losers in society than we really recognize. I mean, at various points in our lives, we're all losers. I think Napoleon Bonaparte was a loser. No matter how successful you are, and how you deal with that, and whether you deal with it appropriately, seems to be a lot of the issue. I think that it was clear when I was writing about Tamerlan that, you know, it was the ideology was something that he clung on to when it was clear that he was not going to be an Olympic boxer, and he ended up being, he was not, I mean, when I knew him, he was planning to go to Harvard, have a sports car, own a house, and, I mean, have a lot of girlfriends. I mean, I tried to persuade him that maybe you ought to do one at a time. He ended up being a pizza delivery guy, and I think that towards the end of his life, he was not depressed at all. I think he was feeling quite fulfilled. My correspondence with Richard Reed sort of suggests a little bit of the same. This might be kind of hard for you to read. I think Reed isn't, I don't get the sense he's a funny guy intentionally. He doesn't like journalists much either. He said he doesn't really like to, he didn't want to correspond with him much because he said that he thought that report, I think that anything that a reporter might, you know, that my narrative will be tainted as to portray a certain image which is suited to the narrative of the so-called war on terror and the idea of fanatical brainwashed enemy of freedom and democracy and the likes. And then lower down, I had asked him, well, do you have any regrets now that you're, you know, in this supermax facility and have, you know, 1 hour a day for exercise and that sort of thing? As for the issue of my decision making in regards to the events that led up to my incarceration, then in general, while there are a few things that I would probably say could have been given a bit more thought and done differently, I still stand by my brothers. By my actions and my support for the brothers I was aligned with. So if there's any thing to say at the end, is that maybe there is a happy ending. These guys do feel fulfilled, even in arduous circumstances. I think that the we in the press write about it as if it's too much of an alien thing. I think a lot of the people who I have been dealing with, I intuitively feel might be similar to quite a few in the West who are just simply those who do not want to live in a complicated world. I think that that's happening all over the world. I think that that's certainly happening in Europe. I see some confluence between the right-wing movements in Europe and what's going on in the Islamic world. But anyway, I'm way past my time, and I'll mercifully end.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.